Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have found a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to episode 54 of Time Sensitive. Today, Spencer's in conversation with the novelist and essayist Siri Husvedt. She's the author of the new book of essays, Mothers, Fathers, and Others. What'd you guys talk about?
Well, exactly that. Mothers, fathers, and others. We got into her own maternal lineage on her mom's side. So her mother's mother, talked to her about her own mother and also becoming a mother. So her relationship with her daughter.
And we talked about extreme therapy session, it sounds like.
It kind of was.
No, but in all seriousness, it's about time through the maternal lineage.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about motherhood more generally too, and notions of motherland, maternal space. Her father's Norwegian-American, her mother is Norwegian. And so we got into all of this, and all of these subjects surrounding motherhood are things she's written a lot about. Siri also has spent a lot of time studying neuroscience, psychology, and psychoanalysis. So we talked about that too. So yes, therapy session. And much of our conversation I found revolved around this one idea, this sort of notion of ambiguity and particularly tolerance for ambiguity. For her, that's what maturity is. I really appreciated this perspective because it's sort of this idea of investigating and embracing what you don't know, sort of honoring the fact that there's so much out there we may never know.
Such an interesting concept. It's like the frustration behind not knowing things, where the maturity comes from being okay with what you don't know and the humility that comes along with that.
And we finished the conversation on Louise Bourgeois, an artist who, that's really what her work is all about.
Very much looking forward to this. Here is Spencer and Siri.
Joining me in the studio today is author Siri Husvedt. Welcome, Siri.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to begin on motherhood in your writing, but also just within the context of time, and specifically the subject of mormor or mother. Could you speak to this both broadly and in your own life and work?
I have become increasingly fascinated with maternity, motherhood, embryology, gestation, birth, both as subjects or objects of study and how they function in the culture at large. You use this word, and I'm going to pronounce it in Norwegian.
Yeah, I might have butchered it.
No, it's fine. It's mormor, which means mother's mother. And in Norwegian, you make that distinction. So you can say farmor, father's mother, mother's mother, or mother's father. So the what you call the grandparent is more specified in the Norwegian language. I had a very wonderful mother's mother. I also had a wonderful mother. I was close to both of them. And the sense that there are aspects of life that are inherited, and by that I do not mean genetic inheritances, that of course happens, that are modified by epigenetics, a big subject now, right? Changes that take place at a molecular level after DNA sequencing. What I'm talking about is something else, mostly unconscious, I think, the way mother gestures, actions, modes of being can be inherited over generations. Mm. I think it was in my family, from my grandmother to my mother to me, and I think then to my own daughter.
Mm. And you've written quite a bit about this notion of what we might call maternal space and the ambiguities around it. As you've written, the simple fact that every person begins inside another person haunts motherhood. Could you speak to this idea of how every mammal begins, this idea of maternal space?
Yeah, we are placental mammals. And this has been, I think, in Western culture, one of the aspects, simply a truth, that has been repeatedly annihilated. Not only in philosophy, where I think the anxiety about this fact that every human being begins inside another person is suppressed and repressed. It's interesting, certainly not in all cases, but even some feminists don't want to address biology, embryology, gestation, something I think it's really important to talk about, especially since the Greeks, we have been throwing this out of philosophical discussion. But weirdly enough, also in the sciences. So yes, I think it has to be recuperated. Because this is not sex defined, right? It's every human being begins inside another person. Surely this should be significant to how we think about human beings and their trajectory in the world.
Mm. And philosophically, how do you view your own experience as a daughter, a granddaughter, a mother? And really, I'm thinking specifically here, and then I'd love to talk to you about your own experiences as a mother, but how do you think about your mother's experience as a daughter across time? How do you think about your relationships to your mother and your grandmother?
Yeah, I think this is fascinating because we are all creatures that are created in complex ways, right? And they're usually divided like this. Biology, psychology, sociology. Sometimes they say biopsychosocial with little hyphens. This is a term that comes up again and again. My point is that those three realms that we like to think of as somehow distinct are actually merged in human beings all the time, right? We are body subjects. We are made of what we're made of, you know, flesh and bone and cells. But those very biological entities that we think of as hard and fast and stuck are, of course, absolutely enmeshed with the environments in which we're embedded. You can think about this in the simplest possible way. We breathe air. We need food. After we're born, and in order to grow up, we need other people to feed us, to move us. Unlike, you know, a little horse, we do not stand up right after we're born. We have to be carried around for almost a year, or we die. In science, it's called we're neotenous. We're neoteny means that we are very slow developing childlike beings for a very long time. So all of that goes together. And psychology, you cannot divide our psychological states either from what's outside us, our culture, or of course from the brain, which is an organ connected to other organs and systems of the body. The brain is not an isolate. Neuroscience has made this error over and over again. Brains do not think. They are not subjects. They are part of a whole body subject. And we know now, recent research shows that there is, you know, gut-brain relations that go in that direction, not only from the brain to the gut and other parts of the body. The force, if you will, of my thinking is that if we're going to address some of the large questions and problems that are now besetting the entire globe, we have to shuffle the categories, right? And that's why I'm bringing up this, you know, biopsychosocial business, because it is so often cut into these little pieces and addressed as if they're independent, and they're not. Mm-hmm. So in terms of motherhood, this is also a fraught topic because, you know, if you read closely, we know that we are living in a culture where the very idea of gender, if you will, is being questioned, which I happen to think is a good thing. Back in the olden days when I was a young person, we talked about androgyny. That's mostly disappeared for an idea of gender fluidity. Mm-hmm. So even trans men, which is an issue now, who give birth with a functioning reproductive system, right? So that is part of their story as well. And there can be a tendency to suppress biological processes. And I think one of the reasons is that people think about biology as a fixed reality. It ain't, right? It is something that is in continual motion. Until we die, we are biological creatures that are moving in multiple ways all the time.
And so tell me about this amorphous, let's say, connection point between your grandmother, your mother, yourself. How do you think about those relationships?
Yes. Well, again, I think change is something very important. So as I write in the essay that you're referring to, you know, my mother had a childhood. She had a youth. Actually, she lived under the Nazi occupation in Norway. She moved to the United States, married my father, had four children, was very much a housewife, invested in raising her children, keeping a perfectly clean, pristine house that she enjoyed. There were also hardships. And then her children grew up, as children do, and her life took another turn. She started working in a library. She loved that job and lived with my father as older people. Sort of now I am at that place in my own life, living with my husband alone in a house. And after my father died, she had another chapter of life. And I thought about this a lot because after my father died, my mother and I had a renewed lease on our relation. I love this phrase from Dickens in David Copperfield. You know, he says, you know, whether I shall be the hero of my own life or not, these pages will determine, probably. Missed that quote a little, but I felt that after my mother died, she had a chance to become the hero of her own life. Again, you know, we do live in a patriarchal culture, and I was born in 1955, right at the middle of the 20th century, when I think there was a real backlash after the Second World War that pushed women into positions of domesticity, enforced domesticity, middle class women, right? And we have to remember working class women and poor women were working their guts out all the way through what we think of as the modern era. But my mother was a middle class woman. My parents had very little money, but they qualified as middle class. And so she adopted that role. And then later, she traveled, she read, she belonged to three or four book clubs. She was able then to go to Norway every summer to visit her family. I visited her often, and she visited us in New York often. So a whole intensity, between us was increased during those late years of my mother's life. She suddenly became rather feeble around 90. She died at 96. But it's important, I think, to recognize, again, that life is not a kind of stagnant pool, right? It's an ongoing reality, and it changes. And if you can't change with it, you know, people talk a lot about reaching happiness or seven steps to a happier you, right? Well, that is a false notion, right? We are emotional beings, and emotions too are continually changing. How would you ever recognize happiness if you hadn't been sad, right? The notion of stasis in philosophy too, and in science, mm-hmm. there's a clinging to static categories, to making the world stand still so it can be understood. When in fact, I think that compromises what's actually taking place.
Mm. It's sort of a, from the sounds of it, like a plea for embracing ambiguity.
Yes. In fact, I've decided in my late life that what maturity is tolerance of ambiguity.
Mm.
I really think so. And this also, this is your subject, right? Time. You know, time is really a mysterious business. Many people go back to Augustine and refer to the famous chapter 11. And we think, in a way, that what Augustine ends up saying is that time may just be in us, right? It may just be part of consciousness, that it's phenomenological, whereas the time of physics, supposedly, I'm not at all sure, and I do not have the physics background to really weigh those questions, is the space-time block real? Is everything simultaneous? You know, did Minkowski figure out that this is actually how it works? And since it only seems to function for the theory of relativity and quantum doesn't fit into it, what does it mean? There are some physicists, a man named Smolin, who thinks that maybe it's all wrong. And, you know, Charles Sanders Peirce had a wonderful thought. He said, what if the laws of physics change? How do we know they don't change? I mean, again, I have no answers to this, but it's enough to not be absolutely satisfied with the models and the answers that have already been given. But back to, you know, living time, phenomenological time, what we experience, human beings, the way we feel that time flows or passes, and what are the markers of that? Well, you know, I can look at a photograph of myself when I was 25 and look at that cute young little face and go, wow, who's that young person? And look at my face now and see time. But there's another thing. I wrote a paper for, it was an academic paper called Pace, Space, and the Other in the Making of Fiction. And what I say there, which interests me a lot, is that time is an abstraction that is invisible to us, right? We don't see it, even though we can look at the clock and mark it on the clock. But timing is not. Right? So timing is internal and can be external, right? We have a heartbeat. We breathe. These are repetitions, versions of timing. Women menstruate every month. That's a repetition that's bodily that we recognize. There are seasons. There's night and day. There are the tides. We live with this. These are forms of timing that are part of the rhythmic reality of our bodily selves. And then it's not so far to expand from that to drums, to music, right? And speaking again, to go back to motherhood or parenthood, all the work, empirical work that's been done on timing between infants and parents, focused mostly on mothers, but actually recent work has extended this to fathers as well. And they do what they call micro-analyses, which are films taken of encounters between parents and children, and then they analyze them very closely. But if you think about the language they use to talk about these encounters, it's rhythmically based. Synchronicities. Proto-conversation is another nice one, because infants don't speak until later, but they make noises. They answer the speaking parent. One wonderful researcher, Daniel Stern, used the philosophy of Suzanne Langer, who I think is the great philosopher, period, of rhythm. She was an American philosopher who talked about these musical rhythms that are part of our biology. She wrote a famous book about music, but later she also wrote about the mind. And the mind for Langer was certainly not divorced from biological processes. So there you have a between space between parent and infant. And what is that between made of? Well, it's social space. And the two are creating something new between them. And that takes us back, I think, to my mother, that our relation developed new forms of a between until she died.
Tell me about your own experience as a mother these 34 years. What stands out to you in your mind from experiences and from your own sort of writing and reading on the subject?
Well, yes, I have a grown-up daughter now. And once, this is years ago now, I was on my way to sleep. And I'm a person who's always been aware of the fact that I have hypnagogic images before I sleep. I've had them since I was a child. I think many people do, and perhaps aren't aware of them. It's not unusual at all. But that particular night, I was dropping off to sleep, and I saw a series of images of my daughter at different ages. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, usually I see random people and houses and landscapes and colors, a whole hodgepodge of pictures that don't present themselves with any obvious meaning. But this time it was images that I recognized of my daughter growing up over time. It was very moving and interesting. And of course, it woke me up. I had to start over again. So there's process as well. I remember someone years ago when my daughter was younger asked me how much all my reading in attachment theory, child development had influenced me as a parent. And I had to answer honestly. I said, you know, I don't think really very much at all. Which is kind of funny. Yeah. I mean, listen, I do think certain kinds of education can perhaps create some levels of tolerance that you might not have. I mean, no parent should treat a four-year-old as if, you know, she or he is a 10-year-old. That's a big error. But most people just feel that. And I think much of my parenting came from my body, my feeling, a sense of protecting the other and respecting the other. That's a little piece of advice my mother gave me before I had a child of my own. She said, of course you love your children, but it's really important that you respect them. And it was a forceful, forceful comment. After a child is born, it is profoundly dependent on its parents and others to be raised. Mm-hmm. But a respect for at least the potential autonomy of that being is really important, right? So boundaries are important. And I think part of patriarchy, right, part of the horrors of patriarchy has been that anointed men have believed that their women and children are not autonomous beings, mm-hmm. right? That they somehow belong to the larger body of the man. We can still see that. And that's an enormous danger. My mother was trying to say, remember that as helpless and irrational as a child might be, mm-hmm. that person deserves your respect as a person.
And before we move on from this subject, which I'm sure we could basically do a whole episode on, it's so fascinating and you have so much to say. Could you speak to the profundity of the mother-child relationship from birth and in those early years? Because I think it's so much in that specific period of time that occurs in the development stage.
You know, I've been working now for several years on a book that I intend to write after I finish the book I'm writing now, on the placenta. And the placenta, as we know, is a mammalian organ. It's transient. It has, with some exceptions, Aristotle being one of them, he was quite interested in the placenta, been totally neglected as a philosophical object, but even as a scientific object. As late as 1974, there was an obstetrics conference in the UK, and the conference was called The Placenta, the Neglected Experimental Animal. Now, I have read that entire, all the papers in the conference, and in some important way, they are, as weird as their title was, they were arguing that even in obstetrics, the placenta had been completely forgotten as a significant organ of gestation and development. Okay, we know not all that much about the placenta. In 2014, the Human Placenta Project was launched. I think much will come of this. I think it's extremely well-funded, and work is being done as we speak. More and more research is coming out of not just that program, but people have turned their attention to this organ. Mm-hmm. I will not go into the rather fascinating science because it is esoteric. But if you think about why the placenta has been neglected, I think it's because it is the between organ par excellence. It is the organ where divisions get extremely murky. And this can be found from the molecular level up. You know, what is a pregnant person? Is it one, two? Is it three with the placenta? How do we count? And then, isn't it a trajectory of development, which means that at the very early stage, even before the placenta develops, you have an embryo that is nourished by what they call, very poetically, uterine milk, which is uterine blood, which is nourishing this embryo. It's not until the second trimester that the placenta really gets going. Then it becomes the third, the one between, the one that's keeping the blood systems separate, but also delivering nutrients, getting rid of waste. It's a miraculous organ. Okay, it does its job. Let's say everything goes well. The infant is born, and the placenta dies. It's also born. It's the afterbirth. It comes second. It dies. And what happens then? What replaces the placenta? Well, the people around the infant have to take charge. You know, clean up the diapers and put the breast or the bottle to the infant, feed it, rock it, because, you know, motor coordination at birth is really iffy. Mm-hmm. A newborn infant cannot move around yet, can't roll over. All of that must be done by the caretakers. So the placenta is replaced by social space, which is exactly what you're saying now. But I think you have to go all the way back, right, to the zygote, to the very beginnings. Mm. And then you see that this act of space between is how human beings develop over time, determine more and more their boundaries. This is still an argument ongoing, like, what is a self? Are we born with a self? You know, how much does a newborn infant know about where she is in relation to the other? What exactly are the boundaries? The science suggests that newborns have a lot more going on than was once thought, and I think this is true. At the same time, they really are radically dependent beings, and without the world of others, without culture, language, you know, we just shrivel up and die.
Mm. And touch. It's a big one.
And touch. I was part of a seminar, Women in the Neurosciences, and the papers that were given were all on the sense of touch. And I think, you know, smell is not far behind. The neglected senses are coming to the fore after cognitive neuroscience has begun to recognize that we really are embodied creatures and all of the senses have to be attended to, not just sight and hearing.
Mm. I wanted to bring up Minnesota and Norway here. Your father was Norwegian-American and your mother, as you mentioned, was Norwegian. You grew up in Northfield, Minnesota. How do you think about the concept of a motherland?
In my case, I think it was always related to the connective tissue of that, which is mother's tongue, right? So I actually spoke Norwegian before I spoke English. My father, who was third generation Norwegian-American, spoke English with a Norwegian accent till he died. Out there in the countryside, that immigrant world he grew up in, they called it a brogue. I mean, they stole from the Irish, clearly. They stole that term, and they called it a Norwegian brogue. So both of my parents spoke Norwegian. I spoke Norwegian first. And the language of my childhood, a language that belongs to all children, right, which is the language of the body, the toilet, food, hugs, you know, comfort, fear, that took place for me often in Norwegian. And there are still times when a subject comes up, usually in relation to childhood or to some deep sensual reality, where the Norwegian word will come first.
Mm.
Even though I have to say, I am much more articulate in English. And my whole, you know, I did my PhD at Columbia, and much of what I've read and learned has not come via Norwegian, but via English.
Mm. Although I was interested to learn, you know, while researching for this, that your grandmother would read Dickens in Norwegian, and you later went on to write your dissertation. Yes. On Dickens.
Yeah, isn't that funny? And she loved Dickens, but she had she never read it in English. Her English was not very good until the day she died. And yes, indeed, I read David Copperfield when I was 13 years old, and it was like an electric shock of joy, wonder, fear, and, you know, just so. And I think it stayed with me. And I didn't know I was going to write on Dickens, but I became interested in questions of language and identity in Charles Dickens. I think he's really what might be called an intuitive philosopher about what human beings are, all kinds of deep aspects of human life are treated by Dickens, even though he was not actively studying philosophy of the period.
I wanted to hear a bit about Northfield. And you know, you're the oldest of four sisters. Your parents had met at the University of Oslo, where your father had a Fulbright fellowship and your mother was a student. Your father taught Norwegian language and literature at St. Olaf College, where you grew up effectively. Could you paint a picture of this time and place for me and your childhood?
Well, you know, it's interesting to ask because from my perspective now, it was another place. Northfield has become a prettier town, if you want the truth, and also a town where many people live who commute to Minneapolis or St. Paul for work. I don't know if that's a bedroom town. I don't know what that's called. But it's always had two colleges, Carleton College and St. Olaf College, where my father was a professor. So we grew up in that town-gown division. The other notable historical event in Northfield is that it was the site of the Jesse James gang defeat. In other words, the citizens of Northfield rose up and stopped the James gang. Two members of the gang were shot. When I was growing up in the bank where this event happened, they had circled the bullet holes in black paint. Every year they had Jesse James Days, which later, after I had left Northfield, was changed to Defeat of Jesse James Days because they didn't want to, you know, honor evil. Anyway, bank robbing. So it was a small town in all senses of the word. My parents built a house outside of town that was my magic kingdom. We had a creek behind the house. My sisters and I played in what I guess is essentially a backyard, but it was woods with a creek. And on the other side of the creek lived the translators of Søren Kierkegaard, the Hongs. Howard and Edna Hong, they had many children, and Kierkegaard has continued to haunt my life from my childhood on.
I mean, literally in your backyard.
Kierkegaard was being translated for the, you know, the definitive Princeton edition right across the creek.
Wow.
So it was 2013, I gave the opening lecture for the International Kierkegaard Conference, so there you are. Childhood influences continue. I remember vividly my father once said to me, well, you know, I understand Kierkegaard's aesthetic and ethical stages, but I do not understand the religious stage. I don't know how old I was. I must have been old enough to think, 12, maybe 13 or 14. And I thought to myself, I'm going to understand that. Think of that. Do I know? Well, I don't know. But it's funny, you know, those shaping thoughts. Mm-hmm. I never forgot it.
Tell me a little bit about your reading life and the importance, I guess, of reading in your family. I know your mother introduced you to a lot of books, William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. When you were 11, you also started reading Emily Dickinson. Your grandmother, as I mentioned, loved Dickens. Yeah. Tell me about this journey as a reader.
You know, there is a moment in childhood when there does seem to be a form of intellectual expansion. I remember that moment when suddenly I could really read small print. And of course, that has nothing to do with the size of the print. It's simply that you are able to ingest language that was too difficult before. I remember that moment as an opening. So when I was 12 and 13, I started reading mostly 19th century novels that my mother handed over to me. Austen, the Brontes, Dumas, you know, the abridged version of the Count of Monte Cristo, Mark Twain, just one book after another. And the pleasure, I suppose, of living the lives of others in an important way, and the expansion that that makes possible of your own consciousness had an addictive quality for me. And it started with literature, but then as time went on, even, you know, in high school, and then, of course, in college, it expanded to reading history and philosophy, sticking mostly to the humanities. But even in college, I remember I got interested in Christian mystics and stumbled across a book about the neurology of mysticism, relating epilepsy, for example, to mystical states. Then I found William James. You see, it's always one book leads to another. And if you're lucky enough to have time to read, those roads can become really elaborate, and they will inevitably hop disciplines.
And enter your own mind and your own work.
Yes, exactly. So there is, again, another static fantasy in the culture about genius, right? That people are just born like that, and it's in the DNA. There may very well be certain genetic factors that are important to a person's, you know, brilliance and how they turn out. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that there may well also be countless people who might have become what we think of as geniuses who never had the chance because they were not developed. And there is no such thing as a born that way, brilliant person or genius. It must be developed. It must come through others, whether it's music or visual art or science. You don't do that in isolation, right? There is no such thing as that. The culture and others are implicated in everything that happens to us. And I do think of books as others, as part of an elaborate network of friendships. Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher that I admire very, very much, did talk about books that way, as forms of friendship. And there's another wonderful man, Abi Walburg, an art historian who didn't write that much, but was a luminous thinker, who had a very eccentric library that he organized according to good neighbors. Books that fit, you know, no one can really make head or tail of what this was about. I mean, I think he has, you know, archivists that have been working on Abi Walburg's library. There's a Walburg Center in London. I know some people who work there, but that's a beautiful idea, right? You spring from, you know, some make complete sense. So Husserl, for example, the German philosopher, read William James very carefully and about time, Right. So what James called the specious present, which means there's no dot in time, right? It's always moving. And so you could make good neighbors of Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, and William James and Edmund Husserl, because there is a real connective tissue in their thinking, and they also read one another. So those familial relations can be developed in a library, but nobody except you could maybe understand. So I stick to the alphabet.
Well, I do love the notion of books as good friends or good neighbors, because on a very simple level, it's just who you want to be surrounded by.
That's right.
I'd love to hear how at age 13, you knew you wanted to become a writer. Was there a particular thing that led to this realization, or?
This is now slightly, self-mythology, but I do remember it, and it may have hardened in my memory, but I have very strong images of it. I was in Reykjavik, Iceland with my family. My father was studying the sagas, and it never was dark. It was the summer. I had a lot of trouble sleeping. I think simply because of the light, my circadian rhythms were thrown to heck for the first time. And we would, close the shutters, but it didn't completely keep out the light. So I just stayed up and read. And I was reading, yes, David Copperfield. And there was a particularly moving scene. I can't remember. It was somewhere in the middle of the book. And I was so struck by it that I put the book down. And I walked to the window and I raised the shade and looked out at the eerie image of the neighborhood in Reykjavik in this thin sunlight of midnight, the midnight sun. And I thought to myself, if this is what books can do, then I want to write them. Was a really
profound for a 13-year-old.
And then I started telling people, it's like, I'm sure they thought I was like a real twit, this little twit. But I really, the ambition was founded, and I began writing horribly, I think as many 13-year-olds do. But I didn't stop after that. I have to say, I was not, even as a child, so arrogant as to think that I would necessarily make a living doing that, right? I think I went to graduate school to secure the possibility of having a real job.
Mm. So you arrive in New York City. It's September 1978. You're in your early 20s. I loved learning that you spent your first 3 days here rereading Crime and Punishment in what you described as a state that closely resembled fever.
I mean, why I did that, it's only when you look back that it's both ridiculous and rather touching. I mean, now as an old person to look back on the young self, I think I must have been paralyzed without really knowing it, right? I had never lived in a big city before. I found myself in an international house in a room that, when I think of it now, was like a large coffin with a sink in the corner and a toilet down the hall, which was fine. I mean, I was not at all fantasizing about better accommodations, but it probably reminded me of Dostoevsky's great book and Raskolnikov's, feverish deliriums and moral nightmare.
And shortly after you arrive, you came across the writing of Juna Barnes.
Yes.
And I have to admit, prior to this interview, I actually wasn't familiar with her work, and you've written quite eloquently about it. I mean, she's, in addition to being a fascinating writer, lived such an incredible life. I'm wondering how you think about her life, her work, in contrast to what you do. I know you wrote her a letter once
I did, yes.
And I'm also curious, just looking back on that time and looking back on this book that you'd read of hers, Nightwood, what your thoughts are around that.
So I believe I was 23 when I first read it, and I gave a paper on it in a seminar. I was gobsmacked, as the expression goes, by the novel. It is, I think, one of the great books about sexual ambiguity, about what is left out of history because of patriarchal forms that do not open themselves to other possibilities. It's really a brilliant book. I've read it 4 times now. I recently wrote a preface for the Spanish. There's a new Spanish translation, I believe, or a new edition coming out, and they asked me to write the preface, which I did. So I reread it for the 4th time. And now I'm old enough to conclude that this is a extraordinary book. It does get a lot of scholarly attention. I think it's one of those novels that kind of rises and falls, even in popular culture. So it is not a forgotten book. She is not a forgotten writer. I think that is her masterpiece, although scholars have also now been turning to the rest of her work as a whole and rethinking it. She was greatly helped by the fact that T.S. Eliot wrote the original preface, even though it's a little grudging. He really admired it, and they became friends, these two. So I don't want to distort the truth. But at the same time, I think there were aspects of that book he simply couldn't enter, or that alarmed him about his own sexuality and may have created anxiety that he couldn't even fully recognize. But she's a fascinating character in the history of 20th century literature, as is the case with many women writers of that period. I think she's finding her way either back into the canon or into the fixed canon, whatever that is, you know, it changes. But I think she's a wonderful writer, and more people should read her. She's a writer for now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was fascinated to learn that in her early career as a journalist, she did these stories that were quite experiential, I guess you could say. She was force-fed in one of them.
She agreed to be force-fed because she was showing sympathy for the suffragettes in England who had been force-fed, which I think we know from Guantanamo, for example. This is a gruesome experience. She was a bold and daring journalist, and that also shows up in her style.
Mm.
She's an amazing stylist. I think some people find it difficult for good reason. It's not easy to read Nightwood. But as I like to say, somewhere I finally have written this little thing that I say, art is like sex. If you don't relax, you won't enjoy it. And Nightwood is one of those books. If you open yourself up to it and stop worrying about whether you are interpreting every sentence correctly, the meanings come through. I often read philosophy like this now. I mean, I read it slowly, but I read it in a state of openness, because often later I realize that more has come through than I imagined. And this is true with looking at paintings, listening to music as well. Tension creates walls between you and the work of art, or, you know, the paper. And also, I think, allows prejudices to act on the experience.
Mm. How do you think Barnes or Barnes's work has informed your own writing, your own thinking about writing. And maybe here you might say a little something about the letter you wrote and the response that came.
So I worked very hard on this letter to Juna Barnes, the only letter I have ever written to a writer I don't know. And I took the material from the paper I had given in the seminar. I realized I wasn't going to send her the paper. I mean, that would be ridiculous. But I summarized some of the points. I wanted it to be a short letter, but pointed and emotionally powerful. I wanted to convey how much the book had meant to me. It had been a convulsion in my reading reality. I wrote it several times. Then when I was happy with it, it was not more than a page long. I sent it off, but there's a preamble to this story. I was, before I wrote the letter, and the reason I could write the letter, I was on the subway pressing Nightwood to my chest in a paroxysm of happiness. And an older woman was sitting next to me, probably a woman the age that I am now, in her 60s, looked over at me and she said, "Oh, I see you're reading Nightwood." And I said, "Oh, I just love this book so much." And she said, "Well, you know, my husband teaches at Princeton and he knows Juna Barnes. Would you like to write to her?" And I said, I hadn't thought of it, right? But I said, "Oh, I think I would." She said, "Well, just give me your address and I will send you a postcard with Juna Barnes' address on it." Indeed, 2 days later, I found a postcard with Patch and Place, Juna Barnes. I do not remember the zip. And then sat down and labored over my missive to Juna Barnes. Well, I didn't expect an answer, but I had moved to Brooklyn. A year and a half later, indeed, an answer came in the mail on an Underwood typewriter. My husband and I pored over it. I think we were married then, or maybe not yet married, but we were close to be married. And he said, "That's an Underwood." And I said, "Wow." And all I remember, this is terrible because I lost the letter, which is gruesome, but she said, "Dear Miss Hustvedt, your letter has given me great difficulty." But, you know, I was so impressed to get it back. Then there was a second line that I've forgotten, and it was, "Sincerely, Juna Barnes." I did not feel it was an insult, and I remember feeling rather happy that I had given her great difficulty. She died only a month later. Mm. I read it in the New York Times. So that may have been the last letter that she sent. No one has been able to find it. I actually, my letter to her, I checked with the archives. Mm. So who knows where that letter went.
You go on to have this incredible journey and career, novel writing, writing nonfiction essays, studying neuroscience, psychoanalysis, studying art, looking at art. Tell me a little bit about this journey beyond the novel, this journey into these other worlds, worlds that I don't think so often novelists are rummaging around in.
No, I think novelists will often enter into these fields because of a novel, right? That it's a form of research. And there are a number of people I know who have definitely done that. But they don't necessarily continue down that avenue. I think for me, I am on an ongoing quest to try to understand more and more about what the human animal mm-hmm. is. And I've also come to believe fervently that no discipline is complex enough to embrace the complexity of human beings. Also, I think I have always been hungry to create a flexibility of mind that I know I didn't have when I was younger and that I envied. Reading certain writers that you just thought, oh, look at that guy. Ernst Cassirer, I remember, made a huge impression on me for the vastness of his knowledge. And I think, again, that one perspective is not enough. This is something I've written about, that if you look at a problem and you approach it from multiple disciplinary points of view, you will not get the same answer to that problem. The paradigms are different. They really are. But you will get what I call a focused zone of ambiguity. And that zone will allow you to ask the next best question or a good question that follows from that investigation. I gave a grand rounds talk in the neurology department at Mass General a number of years ago. But afterwards, this is one of the perks of giving grand rounds talks, they took me around to people doing research. And I visited some young scientists doing research on Alzheimer's and dementia. They told me about their projects. It was fascinating. I asked them questions, and then they asked me some questions. And a young man who essentially spent his days looking at brain scans and trying to understand what they mean, right, in terms of Alzheimer's, said, "You emphasized that someone like me who sits around looking at brain scans from morning till night should also be reading philosophy, history, and literature. Tell me why you think that." And I said, "I think that not because you're going to be more charming at cocktail parties," which is the case, you will be more charming, "but because it will help you in your own work. I really mean this. I have seen it. I have been now at enough conferences with people doing work and sometimes trying to do interdisciplinary work to see that what appear to be intractable issues can, if not be solved, re-seen and remodeled by knowing something about the history of your own field." I mean, many scientists know nothing about the history of their own fields. It doesn't count. All that counts is last year's papers. I'm exaggerating a little, but often this is the case. They're stuck. So the flexibility of mind that comes from understanding philosophical problems or the history of one's own field or having read a novel that shifted your perspective and allowed you to see the world differently, this can help even if you're looking at brain scans from morning till night.
Mm-hmm. Your interest in neuroscience and psychoanalysis, is that somewhat rooted in the fact that throughout your life you've really struggled with migraines? Is that also connected to this experience you have that you write about so beautifully and eloquently in your book, The Shaking Woman or A History of My Nerves?
I think migraine is definitely part of it. And since I've had migraines since childhood, and the migraines I have are, now they distinguish, with aura. So the auras before the headache are fascinating, and they alter your perception of the world, whether it's seeing little lights or colors, or I also had what I called lifting feelings, which were a kind of Alice in Wonderland syndrome. And euphoria, and only once, a what are called Lilliputian hallucinations. I saw a little pink man and his ox on the floor of my bedroom at the time, and that was followed by a whopper of a migraine. So those perceptual changes clearly influenced my fascination with neurology, neuroscience, and also psychoanalysis. I started reading Freud quite early. I think, you know, why do people become who we are? You know, what is involved? And Freud was fascinated by those questions.
You almost became a psychoanalyst.
I thought about it, but actually at the time, the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, which was the premier institute in New York that I thought of applying to, took only one person, I believe, who didn't have an MD. It was, and you know, think of then going to get an MD after your PhD and then doing psychoanalytic training. I mean, I was way too poor to do that, so I had to give that up. And I think it was the right decision, but it didn't stop me from reading about psychoanalysis, which is a long story, ongoing one, which now includes psychoanalysts doing empirical work and all kinds of scientific work as well. But yeah, so the migraine was definitely part of it. And then I realized, you know, after I was out of school, which took a long time, that what was missing and what I'd already become interested in and put in my dissertation was the biological piece of human beings. So disorders such as aphasia disorders started to interest me. And I would pick up lay books. I read Oliver Sacks, you know, had a couple of his books. I read him with great passion, especially the two earliest books that were written for his peers, not as he wrote later for a more general audience, The Migraine Book and Awakenings. And he led me to Luria, wonderful, brilliant neurologist, who I returned to, not just the case studies, I read those first, but then the neurological work and I think very, very important understanding. He had a more romantic view, you know, what Goethe called a romantic science than much of contemporary neuroscience research. The more I found out about the brain, the more I worked on this and even gave talks and even published a few papers, the more I became a critic, especially of what they now call first generation cognitive neuroscience, the model that envisioned the mind as the software of the brain and the mind as a symbolic system that could be separated from the meat, right? If you want to make it really clear. That's what Descartes thought, right? That the mind was somewhere else and you just had this meat, the machine that was moving around. Well, the criticism of that model grew. I mean, it started rather early in the 80s and there were even earlier critics. But by the 21st century, you know, the SH blank had hit the fan and the model was dissolving. And you began to see this in popular culture as well. Neurosexism, the exposure of MRI methodologies, and there was a depression, if you will, in what had been the great high in media about neuroscience as the solution to all our problems, right? Most scientists were not as naive as media journalists and reporters who loved this idea that there's a God spot in the brain and you can reduce, you know, there's your emotional spot, there's your, you know, that's where you do mathematics, you do, you know, if people called it the new phrenology. It was ridiculous. But there were also, to be fair to journalists, papers that were so naive, so philosophically naive, that they published more or less findings that could be interpreted that way.
I mean, you talk about borders. It's putting up walls between things where they don't need to be.
No. The brain remains a mysterious organ in many, many ways. Mm. And to pretend that the working model you're using is definitive is a terrible error. And, you know, any intelligent and careful scientist will admit that. In fact, when you read good papers, they always end with caveats and a list of the shortcomings that are there in that particular paper.
I also wanted to bring up trauma. I know you were in a car accident with your husband, your daughter, and your dog.
Yes.
And you had this series of four flashbacks after that. Was that trauma and that crash, and perhaps you can sort of describe a little bit about what happened, did that also lead to you going more deep into certain subjects in psychology?
I think by then I had really actually immersed myself in a lot of trauma literature from, again, multiple angles, including neuroscience, but also
Sontag.
Psychology and many other aspects of this, including political and sociological aspects of trauma. But it's weird to say, of course, I survived. I do not have any lasting effects from that accident. But I'm actually grateful to have experienced those flashbacks, because I couldn't have understood what a flashback is. I don't think I read about them. I had a sense of what it might possibly be like, but it is so shocking, and it is wordless. There is no real representation, at least in my case, there wasn't. It was motor sensory shock, reenactment four nights in a row of what the collision must have felt like. It's a body memory. I have no conscious memory of the collision. I have absolutely what feel as if they're perfect memories of everything that surrounded it. You know, the moment before the collision, the woman in the van who had left her car, looking through the broken rear view mirror and seeing what was behind us. Very vivid, perfect memories. But the collision is completely gone. But then at night, for four nights, another interesting, fascinating thing that can't be explained is years later, I had another one. Now, that time, I wasn't remembering the car accident. I thought there was an earthquake in Brooklyn. I thought we had been bombed. I had no idea. I woke up in bed shaking, expecting the rafters to be collapsing on top of me. And it took me a couple of minutes to calm myself, but it also took me about 3 minutes to understand what had happened and to relate it to the car accident all those years ago. Now, I know from the clinical material that this stuff happens. Usually there's some, as they say, a trigger, which would be a person moved, say a veteran late in life, hasn't had a flashback for decades, makes a move or loses a spouse, and then a series or a single flashback can come back. I had no ready explanation, nor, of course, do I know if I'll ever have another one. But it is, in a way, an extraordinary experience, unlike any other form of memory.
So I want to finish on your understanding of neuroscience and of the mind as it relates to the writing you've done about painting and art and looking at art. I'm thinking also of a particular artist, Louise Bourgeois, who you've written so much about.
I'm crazy about her.
in all these different essays in different ways. And I, in looking at your work, was just so interested in how the life and mind of Bourgeois has sort of infiltrated your being, if I could put it that way. I was wondering if you could talk about that, about the work you've done in the realm of neuroscience and psychology and the mind as it relates to looking at and writing about art, and particularly the work of Bourgeois.
Yes. So visual art is about visual perception. So the questions involved are, I wrote an essay about this, what does it mean to look at a work of art? I think that to simply talk about visual art as if it were not part of a relation, that is, happening between viewer and thing viewed, as if it is an objective object out there in the world that can be summed up in one way or another, I think that's wrong. I think, therefore, scientific ideas about perception, there is no general agreement. I think we must say that. But the most recent models in neuroscience that I also have some criticisms of and have actually published in a commentary in a journal, nevertheless, take up something that I believe is true, which is the way we perceive the world, we're now talking about vision, but it goes for all our senses, is only through what we've perceived in the past. In the model, they call this priors. That makes sense, right? Our perception is cued by what we've seen before. We apply full consciousness to perception only when what we're seeing surprises us, right? Otherwise, we go along in a fairly rote and unconscious way. You know, if a book spontaneously flies off the bookshelf and hits you on the head, you better pay attention and you have to reorient your expectations. So expectation is dictating most of what we see. In visual art, but also in reading a book, we are also driven by those same expectations that can be fueled by other books we've read, other paintings we've seen. This means that our perception is always inherently biased by the past. So you can begin to see how prejudices, say, against, people who are regarded as low on the hierarchy in a culture, whether it's, you know, the woman writer or the black writer or the immigrant writer, what have you. The knowledge of the hierarchy will actually alter the perception of the thing. It's not that you add the bias on. The bias is part of the perception. So, therefore, the openness issue. Bourgeois, I first saw her work. I saw the big MoMA show. She was already 70 or 71 years old. It made another impression on me, like Juna Barnes. I was awed. And that work then continued to stir inside me. I think way before I was worrying about embodied paradigms in cognitive science, right? How important this is. Before I had read Merleau-Ponty, I had seen Louise Bourgeois' work and would always return to it. She is, I think, a great artist of not just rendering bodily reality or representing bodily reality, but diffusing, complicating, ironizing that, you know, natural groundedness that we all have, not to speak of her beautiful evocations of gestation, pregnancy, and the umbilical cord, all of which fascinate me a great deal. So she came as a, I would call her an ongoing artistic shock, right? The artists I most love, literary and visual, are artists that never cease to surprise me, artists that continue to generate questions on my part. Hey, what's going on? What is this? Artists that I cannot master. This usually creates discomfort in people. I mean, I've seen it in my own case. People are writing about my work, and rather than saying, gee, you know, what's going on? They want to beat the work over the head and try to make it conform to some other notion, some pre-packaged notion of what a novel is supposed to be, for example, or an essay. And I have no interest at all for what I already easily understand. I can just toss that out the window. I'm interested in work that I want to return to again and again because I do not understand it. I haven't made my way all around it. Therefore, I keep writing about Louise Bourgeois. She's not a finished, you know, business for me.
Well, back to where we began, ambiguity.
Yes, the tolerance for ambiguity and especially tolerance for ambiguity in art, because I think in art of many kinds, that is where these ambiguities can be represented and thrive in ways that they cannot in other forms.
Siri, thank you so much for coming in today. This is a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. And be sure to check out our other podcast, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can now find all of our projects in one place on our website, slowdown.tv. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Tiffany Zhao, Emily Jang, Mike Lala, and Pat McCusker.